Coming up on Fronteras, last year more than 1,000 people sought asylum at the San Ysidro port of entry between San Diego and Tijuana. Immigration authorities are seeing a huge increase in asylum seekers at the nation's borders, and the majority are from Central America.
Those government entities that they are theoretically supposed to turn to for protection and support are just unable and in certain respects unwilling to respond to the needs of the public.
We look at what's driving Central Americans to flee north. Congressional candidate Carl DeMaio made national headlines with a recent commercial, but some members of San Diego's LGBT community are not embracing the ad.
When his community, his personal community, was fighting a major civil rights issue, he was quiet.
More on that story, but first the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. Some of Sheriff Joe Arpaio's deputies in Maricopa County, Arizona, have agreed to go through a round of cultural training. The county approved the arrangement to reduce long-held tensions between the sheriff's office and indigenous and Latino residents in a small Metro Phoenix town. From the Fronteras desk, Ju Jaffe Block reports.
Tensions between the sheriff's office and the small town of Guadalupe have been brewing for years. The town's population is just 6,000 people, too small to have its own police department, so it contracts with the sheriff's office. Back in 2009, Sheriff Joe Arpaio conducted a crime sweep to crack down on unauthorized immigrants. It coincided with the town's Easter Vigil, a mix of Catholic and indigenous traditions. The sweep sparked outrage from local officials. Mayor Rebecca Jimenez confronted Arpaio. His response was captured in a PBS documentary.
If you don't like the way I operate, you go get your own police department. You got 90 days to cancel your contract. 90 days. You want to cancel it? Feel free to do it.
We'll look into that.
Guadalupe officials couldn't find another police agency to take over and kept their MCSO contract. Under the new agreement approved Wednesday, the town will come up with a cultural training for deputies. It will explain the town's unique Yaqui Indian and Mexican-American heritage, including town celebrations. Also, if town officials feel like certain deputies are not respectful enough, they can request the deputies be reassigned. Maricopa County Supervisor Mary Rose Wilcox says it's a good compromise.
And so those two clauses were something Guadalupe fought very hard for. They want to get along with the sheriff, but they also want the sheriff to realize there has to be respect from his MCSO officers.
Any training or education my deputies can get is well accepted.
Arpaio says he didn't have a problem agreeing to the new arrangement in Guadalupe.
As I say, it's somewhat of a unique area, and we always can learn.
Arpaio says there are 11 deputies assigned to Guadalupe, and he has plans to crack down on street-level drug dealers there. And by the way, the deputy training in Guadalupe is in addition to a series of court-ordered changes to prevent racial profiling department-wide. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Jaffe Block.
The race for San Diego's 52nd congressional district is expected to be one of the most heated in the country. Freshman Congressman Scott Peters, a Democrat, is facing a challenge from Republican former city councilman Carl DeMaio. KPBS reporter Claire Trageser tells us the race got national attention recently after a DeMaio commercial emphasizes the fact he's gay.
He believes in equality and diversity and is a defender of our personal freedoms.
Carl DeMaio made national headlines with that recent commercial. It shows DeMaio and his partner Jonathan Hale walking hand in hand during a gay pride parade. The Wall Street Journal says it's the first time any congressional candidate of either party has featured a same-sex partner in an ad. But some members of San Diego's gay community have not embraced the ad. LGBT activist Will Rodriguez Kennedy is a Republican-turned-Democrat and has long been an outspoken critic of DeMaio. He views the ad as political opportunism and says DeMaio does not have a track record of advocating for gay rights.
When his community, his personal community, was fighting a major civil rights issue, he was quiet. That speaks to a person's integrity. It speaks to a person's political courage.
DeMaio's had a troubled past with San Diego's gay community. In 2012, he was booed and hissed at during a mayoral debate at the LGBT Center in Hillcrest. Opponent Nathan Fletcher said DeMaio had attacked him over supporting gay rights to win favor with Republicans.
I have never criticized any of my opponents for their position on social issues.
Okay, folks, hang on. We need to show respect to all the candidates.
I have never criticized any of our candidates for their position on social issues, nor will I, because I do not believe the role of the mayor is to advance a social issue agenda. That has been very clear.
A few months later, DeMaio was booed again as he walked in the Gay Pride Parade. Some parade goers booed because DeMaio's mayoral campaign took donations from hotelier Doug Manchester, who is also a strong supporter of banning same-sex marriages. DeMaio declined to be interviewed for this story, but in 2012, he told KPBS he had no problem taking money from Manchester.
Well, I think, you know, obviously I have strongly held personal views, the issues that are important to me as Carl, an individual, a private citizen. But my role as mayor is quite different.
Susan Jester, the president of the local gay Republican group Log Cabin Republicans, says she's proud DeMaio got donations from Manchester.
We should be applauding that. We should be congratulating Carl that such a person, such a powerful man, is willing to put his money behind Carl.
Jester says DeMaio shouldn't have to campaign on gay rights any more than a straight person should have to campaign on being straight.
He's not a gay activist. He was a businessman who happened to be gay, who ran for office and got in on his merits and his experience. So the gay part sort of came along with it.
But Rodriguez Kennedy, the Democrat LGBT activist, sees it differently.
He refers to LGBT equality not as a civil rights issue, but as a social issue, which is a fundamental difference in how you frame an issue.
Rodriguez Kennedy says he doesn't think there's anything DeMaio could do to win back members of the gay community he's lost. But Mesa College politics professor Carl Luna says DeMaio's commercial is likely a smart move. He says now that DeMaio is running for national office, his stance on social issues will be more important, and the commercial shows DeMaio realizes that.
What Carl DeMaio is trying to do is, even before people are really focusing on the election, to rebrand himself and the Republican Party in that district. This is the new Republican Party. It's not last year's closed-minded, deny this and that party of no. Without alienating enough of his base in the primary to win.
But Jester, the Log Cabin president, says voters who don't like seeing DeMaio and his partner in a commercial would likely not vote for DeMaio anyway.
If you alienate 10% but win, you know, 40% or 30%, you're coming out ahead.
The filing deadline for the race is next week. So far, DeMaio is facing Peters and Kirk Jorgensen, another Republican. The top two vote-getters in their June primary will advance to the November election.
I'm Claire Tregesser in San Diego.
The national best-selling book, Enrique's Journey, the story of a boy's dangerous odyssey to reunite with his mother, has been revised and updated. The timing of this updated release comes as more Central Americans, especially children, are heading north to the U.S. in search of their family members and a better life. Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist Sonia Nazario says 18,000 Central Americans are being kidnapped in Mexico every year as they're making this journey, usually by the Zetas. Nazario joins us now to talk about her book and how it informs the immigration debate.
The book is about these millions of single mothers who have come to the U.S. from Mexico, from Central America. They can't feed their kids, see them study past the third grade, so they make this very painful decision to come to the U.S. and leave their kids behind, thinking it's going to be a year or two, but it stretches into 5 or 10 years or more, and these children, I found, despair of seeing their moms again, so they set off on their own to come and find them. And when I started looking at this a decade ago, there was a small army of children coming through Mexico from Central America. Back then, about 48,000 kids a year coming largely to reunify with a parent who had left them behind. And so I wrote about this phenomenon through one boy, Enrique, who his mom leaves him when he's just 5 years old. And so when he's 16, after 11 years of not seeing her, he sets out to go find her. And most of these kids, all they have is a little slip of paper with their mom's phone number on it, and they make this treacherous journey clinging to the tops of freight trains through Mexico. It's a modern-day odyssey.
You talk about this treacherous journey, and you actually retraced Enrique's steps. And what did you encounter, and how dangerous that must have been? What did you see?
Yeah, I did this crazy journey. I met Enrique, so it's a true story, in northern Mexico. He was on attempt number 8 to get through Mexico, and I wanted to put people on top of that freight train and show them what this journey had been like for him. So I went back to his house in Honduras, did it step by step, just like he had done it a few weeks before. So I traveled 1,600 miles and about half of that on top of 7 freight trains. And, you know, these kids, and sometimes I encountered gangsters who control the train tops, who want to rob you and sometimes rape you and kill you, bandits alongside the rails, corrupt cops who are trying to fleece you and deport you back to the southern border, across the southern border of Mexico. So many of these kids, you know, they don't make it through Mexico. That many of them lose their lives. They lose arms and legs to that freight train. And I had many, many close calls and some post-traumatic stress after 3 months of working my way north through Mexico on top of these trains.
Wow. Why did you decide to put yourself in danger to tell Enrique's story?
You know, I think it's very important for people in the United States. From 1990 to 2010, we saw the largest wave of immigration in our nation's history. And with that came enormous hostility in so many communities that hadn't seen immigrants for so long, for many generations in some cases. And so I wanted people to really understand what's pushing people out of countries like Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala. What are they willing to do to get through Mexico? I mean, what I saw these kids do, no wall is going to stop someone that determined. And who are your new neighbors? And so I thought it was a really important story to tell and to write the story of immigration through one boy's quest to reach his mother. It's a very accessible way to try to learn about immigrants.
What is pushing these children and teens to make that treacherous journey? What's driving them?
Well, so since making that journey that I made in 2000 and 2003, really since 2012, there's been a surge in the number of these children coming. The number of adults coming to the United States unlawfully is at a 40-year low, but the number of kids has just surged since 2012. Up until then, the U.S. government was catching 6,000 or 8,000 kids and putting them in federal custody. This year, they're projecting 74,000 children, and that only counts the ones they catch and put into federal custody. So what's really driving so many of these kids, when I was looking at this before, it was really family reunification, abandonment issues, need for work, but now it's really the violence by the Zetas narco-trafficking cartel and the gangs that work with them, MS-13, the 18th Street Gang, really have taken over whole swaths of these three countries in the Northern Triangle of Central America. And they go to schools and elementary schools, and they tell these 9- and 10-year-old boys, you know, as they're coming out, you either join with us and help us move drugs or engage in criminal activities, or we kill your parents. We rape your sister. And so many of these children now are fleeing for their lives.
So they're fleeing the violence. They're looking for the love of their mothers. But what happens when they get here? You really follow this through.
Yes. Well, I think one big problem, you know, a lot of these kids have so much trauma in their home countries and from this journey, but then they face a third trauma, which is our judicial system, because they're apprehended and then they're ordered to go to immigration court to see if they can stay here legally or not. But they're not entitled to a court-appointed attorney to help them in this quest. And so what you see are these children who are expected to mount their legal cases, two-year-old children and five-year-old children who are trembling with fear. I see them in court, and they're expected to present a case in front of this robe judge and complex legal proceedings. And there's an attorney for the federal government arguing to have this child deported. And so what's terrible about this, and I have fought with an organization called Kids in Need of Defense. It's a nonprofit started by Microsoft and Angelina Jolie. We fought to get pro bono attorneys to represent these children across the country, but so many of them are going to court with no help, and they're being deported right back to these very life-threatening conditions. And I believe that the federal government should provide attorneys for children, that in a country like the United States, a child should not be asked to defend themselves in court when the stakes are so incredibly high.
What do you hope will be considered and addressed through possible national immigration reform?
I think that too long the debate has been, the solutions have always been the same three things. More border enforcement, which we now spend $18 billion on per year. We have it on steroids. Guest worker programs and pathways to citizenship. And I think all three of those approaches have really not addressed what I see as the solution. You know, what I see is that when parents come and they leave their kids behind and then the children follow, these separations are really devastating on these families because these kids say, you know, Mom, you said you were coming back in a year. What happened? You abandoned me. And there's huge conflict in these homes where these kids walk up to the line of hating their parents. This inflicts enormous damage on these migrant families. You know, we know that immigration is good economically for migrants and good in other ways, but it is bad for migrants in terms of these family separations. Most migrants I talk to would rather stay at home with everything they know and that they love, their culture, their family, their kids. And so I think we need to work much more diligently to form a foreign policy that tries to deal with this exodus at its source and tries to create more jobs in the four countries, really, that are sending 74% of the migrants who come to the U.S. Unlawfully. And I think there's a variety of things that we could do along those lines to try to bolster jobs, especially for women in these countries, so they wouldn't feel forced to leave.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist Sonia Nazario. Her book, which has just been revised and updated, is Enrique's Journey, the story of a boy's dangerous odyssey to reunite with his mother. Nazario is giving a lecture at Trinity University April 2nd at 7 p.m. It's free and open to the public. There's still more Fronteras coming up. We look at how the violence we just heard about is fueling a dramatic rise in the number of Central American asylum seekers. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. This past year, the number of foreigners claiming that they feared returning to their home country when apprehended at the U.S. border more than doubled. About two-thirds of what are known as credible fear claims were made by people from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Reporter Jill Replegal was recently in Guatemala and has this report.
It's a cool, sunny morning in Guatemala City. A vendor hawks the country's most popular newspapers, Prensa Libre and Nuestro Diario. The pages of these daily newspapers are frequently filled with reports of brutal acts of gang and drug-related violence. It's the same in Honduras and El Salvador. Just down the street from the newspaper vendor is the Casa del Migrante, a way station for migrants headed north to the U.S. or recently deported. Here I meet Maria, a 63-year-old petite Honduran woman. She fled her neighborhood in the coastal city of San Pedro Sula in early January, along with 12 family members. She shows me a newspaper clipping about the murder of a young man in a wheelchair.
Me mataron a mi hijo el 27 de febrero del 2011.
The man was her son, shot dead 3 years ago by suspected gang members.
Me balearon otro.
Gang members shot another of my sons, she says. They threatened to kill my youngest, and because of all this, I had to flee my country, she says.
The situation in Central America, in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, has become so extreme.
Thomas Borman is an expert witness in many asylum cases involving Central Americans.
The population truly lives in a state of civic helplessness in which those government entities that they are theoretically supposed to turn to for protection and support are just unable and in certain respects unwilling to respond to the needs of the public.
Maria's goal is to get her family out of Central America.
Me gustaría, pues, Estados Unidos o Canadá.
She'd like to go to the U.S. or Canada. Her prime tool for getting there is a folder she clutches tightly to her middle. It's thick with the family's documents, including evidence, like the newspaper clipping, that she hopes will ultimately win them asylum. In the last 5 years, there's been a more than 500% increase in the number of people arriving at the U.S. border claiming they're being persecuted or otherwise fear returning to their home country. More than 1,000 people walked up to the San Ysidro port of entry between San Diego and Tijuana last year and asked for asylum. Borman says the trend puts immigration authorities in a tricky spot.
The U.S. government has a fear, and it's not an illegitimate fear, that if it starts granting immigration relief based on assertions of persecution by gangs and other criminal groups, that these floodgates will burst open.
But he says the number of Central Americans seeking asylum in the U.S. is still small compared to those who come for the classic reasons, work and family ties. At the migrant shelter in Guatemala, two young men from Honduras play dominoes across a plastic table in the patio. I ask one of the players, Jose Antonio Urbina, why he's trying to get to the U.S. I'm looking for a better life, he says, and mostly because my family is in the U.S., my mom, my son. Urbina says he was deported last year after living in Los Angeles since 1998. But some legislators think people like Urbina might lie about their motives if caught at the border. Congressman Bob Goodlatte thinks that fraud could explain the sharp increase in Central American asylum seekers.
Because of our well-justified reputation for compassion, many people are tempted to file fraudulent claims just so they can get a free pass into the United States.
Goodlatte is chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. He's held two hearings on asylum fraud in recent months. Despite Goodlatte's concerns, most of the lawyers, academics, and asylum experts I spoke with doubted that Central American migrants were trying to game the system en masse. Borman, the Central America expert, says making it easier to deport people who say they fear persecution could have tragic results.
In so many instances I'm familiar with, that really is tantamount to torture and murder.
Back in Guatemala, Maria and her family are thinking about their next move. God knows we're not lying, she says. We can't live in our country anymore, she says. Reporting from Guatemala, I'm Jill Replogle.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.